Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and brought to you by Checkpoint. Big thanks to them for paying the bills this week. On this week's show, we'll be joined by Gartner analyst Andrew Walls, who's got some less than reassuring things to say about the security of your job in the long term. Apparently, that great big destructive explosive meteor called outsourcing is due to collide with that peaceful, prosperous planet InfoSec. And when it does, it's not going to be pretty. There's going to be like arms and legs and stuff everywhere. So, but yeah, that's coming up soon. Not exactly a cheery story. I should mention, before we get into this show properly, that on our other podcast, Risky Business 2, or RB2, our correspondent Paul Craig has interviewed some hackers who use frickin' laser beams to determine your frickin' keystrokes. They can sniff your keystrokes by pointing laser beams at your laptop to sense the vibration on them. That's really cool. They've also got some attacks they can do over the power grid to sense keystrokes from PS2 keyboards and stuff. So that interview should be up within a couple of hours from this podcast going live. So go check it out at risky.biz when you get a chance. That's on Risky Business 2. But also on today's show, we will also be hearing from Steve McDonald, who is Checkpoint Australia's Engineering Services Manager. And he'll be discussing a softening in the stance of security companies when considering hiring people with a somewhat dark or a little bit shady or grey past. With guys like Jeff Moss on Department of Homeland Security advisory panels, can we still expect to hear the CEOs of large companies tonking on about how they don't hire hackers? Or will they just look a bit backwards if they do these days? That's coming up later. First up, however, it's time for a look at the week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, first up in this week's news, it looks like Apple are patching this is a beautiful bug. It looks like a bug in the iPhone that's triggered by a bad SMS.
Now, this is kind of like the holy grail of phone attacks, you know. The vulnerabilities that you can deliver remotely via SMS are just, you know, that's gold stuff right there. So Charlie Miller reported it announced it publicly at SciScan in Singapore. He says you can get remote code exec as root via SMS on iPhones. All right, so that's big stuff.
It is big stuff, especially when you consider that, you know, the iPhone has a camera in it. It's got a GPS. It can tell people, you know, what you're looking at. It can tell people where you are, all of that sort of stuff. So if you're going to own someone's device, you know, you turn on the microphone, have a listen in. This is a good device to own.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, this is, you know, gold standard phone bugs.
Well, I remember seeing, there's the Metasploit framework you can actually get on an iPhone as well. So I imagine that if you pwn someone's iPhone, you can load it up with Metasploit and then start attacking their wireless LAN once they go to work.
Yeah, stuff on their local wireless network, and that would be a very good vector to break into someone's home network, you know. That's, I don't think you can underestimate the seriousness of this vulnerability. Of course, we don't have any details yet. So we'll have to wait and see how practically exploitable it is.
Well, it looks like, Mr. Miller is playing nice with Apple at the moment. But, you know, I think we were just talking about this last week or the week before about someone had released an SMS fuzzing tool. And, you know, SMS ain't that simple anymore because you've got all of these MMS capabilities. You've got, you know, pictures. You can send audio. You can send a number of different things that are quite complicated media types. And you'd think there would be potential for these sorts of attacks, and here we go. There is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it'll be interesting to see what it is. I mean, I think we were talking a couple of weeks ago that, you know, the important thing about a vulnerability is knowing that it exists, not necessarily knowing what it is, right? I mean, the fact that there's something there to find, now that's public, you know, someone's going to find that the trigger for that very soon, and maybe we'll see it weaponized and in the wild.
Don't give them ideas.
It's, I guess it's time to get patching, huh? As soon as Apple gets the patch up.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how long that takes. That could be a story we'll be discussing in a month or so. But, look.
Well, I hope they patch it a bit quicker than that. Because, I mean, you know, you look at SMS, like, what could this possibly be? Well, okay, like, I'm thinking, you know, multi-byte character sets across multiple text messages being reassembled into one, right? I mean, that's the obvious vector, I think. And it's probably what it is, you know? Of course, that's just conjecture, but I'm sure there's plenty of other people who thought the same thing, start looking, and it won't take long to find, I bet.
Well, it is wormable stuff too. You can imagine that if you put that onto an iPhone and then just had it replicate the attack to everyone in the address book, you'd be stuck with like a ye olde Outlook worm, but for the iPhone.
Yeah, and of course, Apple users kind of hang out together because they're like that. So yeah, attacking a wire or something through this book on a phone, yeah, it's, it'll propagate fast. You know, we might see the mobile Warhol worm.
Well, it's funny, actually. I read a story about a columnist from The Age, which is a broadsheet newspaper based in Melbourne, about how they went to queue up for their iPhone and they were surrounded by all these ghastly PC users who actually use them as well. So I don't know that it just is Apple users anymore. It's just become the in device lately, hasn't it?
Yeah, they are pretty popular. And they're not awful phones, to be honest.
You've got one.
Yeah, it's embarrassing for everybody.
Well, look, on to another story about an interesting bug, and I'm stoked to be able to say that Risky.biz, as in yours truly, got this story out before anyone else did, mostly due to the fact that it sort of broke, all of the events relevant to this story sort of broke after hours in the US, and it just happened to be lunchtime here in Australia. But Barnaby Jack, who's a very well-known researcher, I mean, I've been
Kiwi, by the way.
And a Kiwi. I've been up to my ears in his research in the past. He did some very interesting stuff on ARM and Xscale null pointer bugs, like a few years ago.
They're referencing null pointer bugs, yeah.
Yeah. So this guy is like a rigidige, like, amazing researcher, and he was due to jackpot an ATM live on stage at Black Hat. And perhaps not surprisingly, the vendor, which had initially agreed, from what I understand, to allow this talk to go ahead, got cold feet at the last minute and asked Juniper to pull the talk, and they did.
Yeah, it's certainly a Cisco gate there, but I wonder if Barnes is going to go quit his job over it.
Well, it's hard for me to say, in all honesty, Adam, it's hard for me to say that this is a bad call.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can see what you're saying, right? I mean, certainly jackpotting ATMs is, people understand that. It's very real, watching the money spit out, and it'll get lots of publicity, and I'm sure the ATM vendor would be very sad panda. I hope it's Diebold, by the way. That would be hilarious.
Yeah, look, I'd say it almost certainly is Diebold, but this isn't some theoretical bug about DOSing Cisco routers. This is real stuff. I mean, we've got problems with Romanian gangs here in Australia who are turning up and doing all sorts of skimming and stuff, and I can imagine that if they got a hold of this bug, they would just go to town with it. And I believe the problem is that it isn't actually, as it's turned out, it's not actually vendor specific, so it could be used. I think there's a number of vendors that need to patch before this information is sort of safe to come out into the public, and that was the concern. So it's hard to say.
Sounds like you know more than you're letting on there, man.
Well, this is just from what I'm hearing on the grapevine. And yeah, from what I understand, this is this sucks that they had to pull the talk, but at the same time, it could be, it would be used by bad people to do bad things. So it's a little bit hard to sit there and say, oh, you've pulled a sort of Cisco ISS, like what happened with Lynn back in 2005. But you sort of see what I mean by this, don't you? I mean, this is a tangible cash reward attack.
Yeah. Of course, us, security researchers, we all want to see the root shell pop on stage, right? And the consequences are often secondary to our, own personal amusement there. And that's not necessarily always the responsible thing to do. I accept that.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I suspect that if this research doesn't go public within the next 2 years, then we can start complaining about it. But, like a multi-vendor ATM jackpot floor, you might want to keep that under wraps for a little while.
I understand what you're saying there, but still, damn, man, that would have been a good show.
Well, what you were just saying about the iPhone SMS, that people know that bug is there now, I suspect that now that people know this bug is in ATMs and that it's perhaps cross-platform, there's going to be a lot of people looking into that one. So if anything, it'll give the ATM manufacturers a bit of a kick up the bum and get them looking at it, looking at fixing it. But then again, you can't just nip down to your local Tandy and buy an ATM, can you?
Well, no. But on the other hand, I had a colleague who was working on some ATM software research for a while, and he just emailed a bunch of ATM vendors and said, oh, hi, I'm doing some eval of ATM software for my bank. Would you mind sending me some? And, they sent over, their software emulators and the full software stack for him to play with.
That's not bad. Was he actually working for a bank, or did he just say he was working for a bank?
No, he was just a dodgy Englishman.
Nice, man. That's really cool. Did he find stuff?
I couldn't possibly say.
But he was last seen heading towards Brazil on board a luxury yacht.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I actually have seen one of my colleagues jackpot an ATM, so there you go.
Moving on, and this is an interesting story. Commonwealth Bank here in Australia has been subjected to, I mean, its customers have been subjected to one of the most prolonged and serious phishing campaigns I've ever seen. Everything from voice phishing to email phishing to, you know, the whole lot, but it's just been sustained over a really long period. And now it looks like they've been fending off a DDoS for the last couple of weeks.
So, yeah, it makes you wonder if this is the kind of the new way that we're going to see online banking being targeted. We have much more focused, much more intense targeted attacks rather than, it being a smattering of spam here and there, phishing here and there.
But, no one's really made it clear what the purpose of this DDoS would be. They just know that it's some sort of attack. They can't quite pin down the source of the attack either because they've just got so many transactions running through their systems at once that it's actually proving a little bit hard for them to tell exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, well, I guess, these things can be very difficult to track down. Even, relatively simple hacks and compromises can involve, fairly detailed log analysis. So, yeah, I have sympathy for them having to dig through significant amounts of transactional data and things. But, yeah, I suppose it would also be better if they were, a bit more upfront with exactly what they're, what they're seeing, what they're expecting, a bit more open with their customers about it.
I don't think they actually know. I think there's some genuine confusion. I know I've got people close to the situation who would say that they just noticed that load just went up. And at first they thought that it could have been a seasonal thing because it's the end of the financial year.
Yeah.
And it actually took them a little while, because they've got new online statement functions and they've got all of these extra bells and whistles. And I think in the early days, they just thought that it was their own systems falling over. And then they've done the load calculations and gone, hang on, no, that's still not right. We should have capacity. So I think this is one of the problems when you've got such a complicated online application. It's sometimes difficult to tell when you're being attacked.
Well, I suppose at least if you can't tell, it can't be that bad, right?
Well, yeah. No, I mean,
I'm
actually...
telling that to customers, eh?
Well, I am a Commonwealth customer, and I, of course, did what everyone does towards the end of the financial year and tried to pay everyone who, I owe money and do all of that sort of stuff. And I encountered a couple of problems, but, it froze when I tried to send a transaction away. But then, I logged in again 5 minutes later and it had gone through. That was about the extent to which I noticed it. But yeah, interesting that we don't know why someone is doing this. Perhaps this is a trial for some other attack on someone else. Maybe they're testing this botnet on CBA. Who knows?
Yeah, or, maybe it's, malicious, with some kind of grievance against the bank, its employees or something. Or, yeah, it could just be this is the way things are going to go for everyone eventually.
Well, that is one seriously disgruntled ex-employee, if ever I've heard of one. Now, we'll whip through these last couple of stories pretty quickly. Interesting little piece here by Asher Moses of the Sydney Morning Herald describing these SMS, fraudulent SMS messages that have been flooding into Australia lately, prompting warnings from our actual sort of communications and media regulator. People are getting SMSs from Asia, which are saying, I'm going to kill you. Unless you contact this email address. So it's part of this scam campaign, and it's pretty nasty stuff because there's some people out there who are just freaking out.
Yeah, well, understandably, if you were a vulnerable person to start with, getting, death threats via SMS, that's really not going to help you.
No. I mean, I can imagine, if my mum's walking down the street and her phone goes, beep, 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 and she picks it up and it's some dude saying, I'm going to kill you unless you send an email. Well, I mean, in the case of my mum, she'd probably just ring me and ask me what to do, but I can imagine that for a lot of people, that would just be incredibly frightening.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a pretty pretty nasty spam campaign they've got going on there.
And it comes hot on the heels of another SMS spam campaign, which tells people they've won $123,000 but have to pay like a $900 courier fee or whatever to get the card loaded with all the cash. Pretty typical 419 sort of thing. But
yeah, and at least those kind of look more obviously like a scam. But yeah, actually being, having threats made against you, that's a new twist on it.
It is. And I hope those people get rounded up in some country where that sort of behavior winds up getting you a right royal spanking. So if you're out there, people, I hope you get caught. The month of Twitter bugs, which we've discussed on the show previously, it has actually gone live, and it looks like first up, everybody's taking a look at these URL shortening services, and they've actually found a bug in bit.ly, which is one of the URL shortening services.
Yeah, some kind of cross-site scripting, according to the reports, and yeah, I guess if that gets you access to the being able to send tweets from other people's accounts, then yeah, that's a pretty real bug for Twitter users. I understand the bit.ly thing is integrated into some of the fairly common Twitter applications, the client interfaces that people use. I guess that's a pretty real bug.
Well, you know, what I find funny about this is to exploit a cross-site scripting vulnerability, typically you need a pretty long URL, right?
URL shortening service, yeah.
So maybe what they need to do is then shorten it with another URL shortener.
Yeah, well, maybe we need a vulnerability, you know, shortening service.
That could be fun. What do we think about this month of Twitter bugs? I think we've already touched on it briefly, but, it seems to be turning up some interesting stuff already.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit interesting, eh? I remember reading a discussion a few years ago about, when the full disclosure debate was really happening hard, about whether it's possible to do responsible disclosure for hosted web applications, like whether it is at all meaningful to tell the general public about bugs in applications that are essentially on hosted managed platforms and not deployed by end users. In the case of something like Twitter, whether it is responsible disclosure to disclose bugs and then rather than just telling Twitter about them. Perhaps if they don't fix them, it's an issue. Mind you, I suppose in this case, it is third-party applications rather than Twitter itself. But yeah, I think the whole month of bug things overall is good. It helps us focus our otherwise, spread attention on one thing, and that's good. I hope Twitter have been kind of ramping up their security community interaction team to try and make the most of it. Just having a bunch of people looking at their apps and looking at how the users interact, that's got to be good for them, I think. They're getting essentially a free security audit, so, I hope they're making the most of it.
That's right. I hope they should send these guys a case of beer. That's what I say.
Absolutely, well, yes. Twitter, please send them a beer.
And send us a case of beer for helping to raise awareness, because we're raising awareness.
We're doing our bit for the community, yes.
And it's now, all about the community.
It's thirsty work.
Okay, Adam, that takes us to the end of the news. Thank you so much for joining us again this week, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Not a problem, but I look forward to next time.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at the week's news. Now, before we get into this week's feature, a reminder that the eCrime Symposium is coming up in Sydney on the 4th of August. More details on that at ecrimesymposium.com. Also, there's an Australian Information Security Association members lunch next week in Sydney on the 9th of July. More information on that one, of course, at aisa.org.au. But next up, it is time for our feature interview, and we're going to be chatting with Gartner's Andrew Walls. Andrew is an InfoSec analyst with that company, and he's been attending Gartner's big security summit in Washington, D.C. So I thought it would be a good idea to get Andrew on the line and ask him if this recession business, this big GFC-induced recession, is likely to see lots of jobs shed in the security sector, despite projected growth in the medium term in the InfoSec industry of around 5% per annum, well into 2010. But as you'll hear, it's not actually the recession that's posing the biggest threat to your job. As far as Andrew can tell, outsourcing is.
Well, over the next 18 months, I don't think we have serious concerns, but I think longer term, we do have some serious issues that we need to grapple with, specifically in the area of InfoSec employment. This was summed up real nicely by one of our managing VPs who did a keynote here yesterday at the Security Summit in D.C. Chris Burns was focusing on the issue of what is your role in security going forward. And we took a parallel to what's happening in the standard IT management, data center management world. And increasingly, if you want a job in data center management or basic IT operations management, you better want to move to Pune or Bangalore. The increasing enthusiasm for outsourcing and for the use of services means that many of the traditional employment options that we've had in the past for IT ops and now increasingly for information security are no longer inside the end-user operations, what I would consider our end-user clients. They're moving into service centers. They're moving into software as a service providers, infrastructure as a service providers, data center hosters. And that's a threat.
So you really think that IT security jobs could be at risk from an outsourcing trend?
Very much so. I don't see this as a minor short-term issue based on economic problems. The issue is really as to whether IT security remains relevant in most organizations. For years, we've all been fussing about how we need to align ourselves with the business. We need to support the risk management objectives of the business. All those sorts of, you know, if you will, political statements of direction for information security. But then when push comes to shove, the business starts using software as a service without batting an eye. They don't stop to ask whether the security is aligned with their business objectives or any of that. So when it comes down to how does the business vote through action, it's fairly clear that many businesses do not actually prioritize security in their selection of services or products. We as security professionals need to look seriously at that. We've been pursuing this business alignment stuff and business support stuff for a long time, and frankly, it doesn't seem to be changing the behavior of business leaders. We do hear a little bit more conversation about risk management, but the popularity of a lot of cloud-oriented and software-as-a-service-oriented services tells us that maybe security isn't a big priority.
Surely, though, a few nasty software-as-a-service incidents and a few major data loss incidents would give a bit of a wake-up call to a lot of companies who take that path. And secondly, you'd think it would encourage regulators to actually legislate against loose outsourcing deals. Surely, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Not really. I haven't seen anything in my own lifetime to support that. In a discussion I was having earlier today with a client here at the summit, I was pointing out that I seem to remember some years back, Chrysler came to the government for a bailout, and we bailed them out here in America. And then they came back again, and guess what? We bailed them out again. So where was the regulation? Where was the risk management? Where was the change in corporate culture because of a major security incident or a major failure of risk management in that case? Well, clearly nothing really was done, and we've seen that pattern maintained over and over again. So I don't think we can say all we need is a major incident and business will wake up and suddenly change their approach. Business is driven by profit, and as long as we can generate sufficient revenue to cover our costs, including the cost of a security incident and the reputational damage involved, if it's cheaper to push for more revenue and not deal with the cost of prevention, well, then the business is going to push for revenue.
Mm.
And I think we need to be very serious about that.
I just want to go back to the medium-term outlook for a moment, Andrew, and all of the projections that I've seen from various analyst firms, including you guys and Frost and Sullivan and all of those guys, all point to fairly solid growth in the security sector over the next couple of years. Is that something that you're seeing as well? Is that something you concur with?
Yeah, well, we see solid growth in sales of security software, security infrastructure, and so forth. It does not necessarily mean growth in employment. And so we need to be careful about our distinction there. Although we're seeing some short-term, 6 to 9 month flat budget in a lot of InfoSec shops, many of the organizations we're talking to are still seeing, you know, budget growth in the single-digit percentages over the next 18 months. And the expectation we have is that we will see a continued investment in security infrastructure and security services in particular.
And looking at this outsourcing trend, which types of jobs do you think, I mean, if you do work in information security in a Western nation and you're worried about your job going over to India, what is the safest sector within the IT security sector? I mean, what are the safer job types that you can maybe tell our listeners maybe they should be heading that way?
Well, clearly there's a real good one for outsourcing contract management specialist.
That's depressing, Andrew. That is really depressing.
I'm saying that quite facetiously. No, the core skills that are going to need to be retained by most organizations are the ones you would expect, which is strategy, architecture, governance, enforcement activities, and so forth. And there will be a continuing need for security professionals with solid communication skills who can act as the intermediary between the business units and the outsourcers, so they can translate business directions into security strategy, security priorities that can then be communicated as SLAs and contract performance requirements to whichever service provider. And although we are talking about India, we just hold that up as an extreme example. Many of the service providers we're talking about live right next to you. So in Australia, we've seen the rise of many very strong managed security service providers who are doing firewall management, IDS, IPS management, log management, incident management, identity management as a service, all sorts of things from local domestic providers as well as regional providers.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily that one is going to have to shift countries to keep doing this, the job you've always done. But you may be shifting employers within your own geography. But in terms of staying within the end user client, yeah, a lot of those core skills are still going to be there. But a lot of things are going to move out as a service-oriented organization.
So I'd imagine things like web application reviews, exploit research, stuff like that. I mean, you know, that would be the sort of stuff that is location independent, very technical, and you know, you really could send that off to a group of Indian workers. Or something. I mean, look, I remember doing a story about Infosys back in 2003 when I was working for ZDNet, and I think it was one of the tabloid newspapers in Melbourne or Sydney wrote this story about how Indian workers were coming in and taking the jobs of people from Telstra and whatnot. And, you know, I went to interview this guy from Infosys, who was the country manager, who basically said, look, you know, every year we get something like 400,000 applications from top 10 graduates in India to come and work for us. So it's really about capability and cost. And he said, you know, like no Australian IT graduates wanted to do COBOL. They just don't want to do it. They want to do the sexy stuff. So, his argument was basically like, you know, if you had a major COBOL legacy project to do, you would give it to Infosys because no one else here wanted to do it. I mean, exploit research is a little bit different and, you know, web application reviews are a little bit different, but I can see that it would make sense for that function eventually to wind up in the hands of outsourcers. Sad but true.
Yeah, very much so. And we're seeing more and more of that kind of outsourcing going on. I had a surprising conversation today with a client here who's actually from Minnesota. So it's way up in, you know, the land of lakes and frozen north and all that sort of stuff. And she wanted to get some advice about working with three companies that she named right off the top of her head, all based in Bangalore and Mumbai, for doing outsourced development work for her. And I was stunned. I didn't even know they were operating outside of Southeast Asia. But they had connected with this company in Minnesota and were offering to do, you know, security application development as an outsourced function for them. And the company was looking at it very carefully. But like you say, it's not just a matter of low cost. There was a time, you know, that India was known as the low-cost king, but that was really more oriented around, if you will, less skilled services, you know, call center operations, stuff like that. The development operations that we're seeing in terms of software development in the information security space or in the web application development space are extremely sophisticated, very scalable, with aggressive wages, but aren't necessarily the lowest wages you can find in the world.
Mm.
These are quite capable operations that are offering high quality services. Some of them are owned by Australian companies.
I tell you, Andrew, I was at a Gartner summit in Sydney several years ago, and that was focusing on outsourcing. And I remember one of the analysts saying, you know, they call these places sweatshops, but the only sweating that goes on in a lot of these development houses goes on in the company jacuzzi.
That sounds about right. And some of these, I've been to some of the campuses in India where these companies operate, and you would have thought you'd just stepped onto Google.
Yeah.
Very nice places, very professional, well-run, people that are enjoying their jobs, are ambitious and energetic. So, you know, the concept of some nasty, you know, five-flight walk-up, you know, in the slums, that's not what we're talking about. These are very professional organizations, and they're doing good work. And they do constitute a threat to traditional operations models in a variety of places in the world. And anyone who works in IT operations, in IT development, in information security management, in infrastructure, you know, management of security infrastructure, firewalls, IDS, IPS, needs to be looking over their shoulder and not just feeling threatened, but thinking about how can they do their job differently to offer better value to their organization. What can they do to beat the outsourcer at their own game? And start looking for better ways to, you know, entrench themselves in the organization, to exceed the quality of the services that the outsourcer might be able to provide, and so forth. And this is not new.
Andrew, it's sort of sad, isn't it, that these days the average employee in the IT security sector has to be that Machiavellian and that sort of calculating about their career. I mean, in the good old days, all you needed to do was keep your job was, you know, keep reading your technical stuff, keep turning up every day, don't be late, don't piss off the boss, you know, don't grope your co-workers, just, you know, all of the basic rules. And it sounds like from these days you have to be this plotting, conniving, shark-like thing that, you know, if you stop swimming, you're going to drown.
Well, I wouldn't think of it as conniving, cynical, or Machiavellian. I would say that to be successful in business, you have to be a business person.
Do you think that's fair for people who are technical?
Sure, why not? I think Steve Jobs got to where he is by being technical and being an astute business person. Fundamentally, the business we're in is going through a lot of change, and we have got to change with that if we're to remain relevant to our employers.
What sort of timeline are we looking at for this outsourcing trend to become the norm?
I would say over the next 5 to 8 years, we should anticipate, one, a lot more managed security services dominating the provision of the, shall we say, the commoditized security functions, firewall management, log management, IDS, IPS management, and so forth. Managed security service providers will come to dominate the delivery model for those services. And that cuts across small, medium, and large businesses. They simply have the flexibility and the scalability to offer, you know, highly sophisticated expert services. In the other areas, it will be much slower because those services are just really being designed now. So out of those highly commoditized services, it will be a bit slower to kick into place. But we're seeing very large service organizations in the region, Southeast Asia, like Wipro, Tata Communication Services, and so forth, bringing to various countries throughout the region, very strong professional services groups at very aggressive prices. And so there's more and more of an interest in employing contract worker, you know, services in terms of warm bodies that can do security work to enable businesses to scale up rapidly for a project, but then scale down rapidly when they no longer require those rather expensive experts on staff. And that mode's going to continue for quite some time.
Well, Andrew Walls, I would say thank you, and I would say it's been a pleasure, but truthfully, mate, that's all frightfully depressing. You know, cheers. Thanks for dropping by with the news, you know.
In chaos, there's opportunity, Patrick, so never give up hope.
Okay, mate. Well, look, in all seriousness, thank you very much for taking some time out to have a chat to us this week, and we'll have a chat to you again soon.
It's my pleasure. Talk to you later.
Gartner's Andrew Walls on the line from Washington, D.C. there. And sorry about the crappy audio quality. That's what you get when you ring a cell phone in another country in another hemisphere and record the results. But moving on, and it's time for this week's sponsor interview now. You all know who Checkpoint Software are. They've been in this industry since the dawn of time. And they've also been a very long-time supporter of Risky Business and helping us to pay the bills and justify putting a lot of time, frankly, into the program to bring you this show every week, week after week. So we really do owe them a big thank you for helping us to keep going. But look, in this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Checkpoint's Engineering Services Manager here in Australia, Steve McDonald. Now, I don't know if many of you have heard about this, but in the US recently, a 19-year-old phone freaker who's actually legally blind has been sentenced to 11 years prison for a bunch of offences. Now, this kid was a bit of a douche and would do stuff like sending SWAT teams to the houses of people he didn't like, but still, in my mind, 11 years seems a pretty radical sentence. Now, this comes just a couple of weeks after we learned that Jeff Moss, a man who's admitted to doing a few slightly dodgy things in the past, has been asked to sit on a Department of Homeland Security advisory panel in the USA, and it's an interesting little clash there. So this tells us one thing, which is the dynamic between the establishment and the so-called hacker scene has changed. Past sins have been forgiven, it seems, but new sins are still being punished. And gone are the days when people who dabbled in badness at one point in their career are considered completely unemployable by the security sector. Remember when companies like ISS and Symantec used to say, "We don't hire hackers," in their sternest voices? Well, I suspect that's all changed. So I got Steve on the show to discuss this changing dynamic.
Well, look, I'm sure when we're all youths and young, we're all doing crazy things all over the place. Some of us choose to do a bit of freaking, and whether or not you get caught, I guess, is a major input factor into your eligibility for things later on in life. But security professionals and government employees are, you know, all pretty good at having endless steering committee and planning meetings. People like Moss obviously will bring to the table hopefully a little bit more immediacy. And, you know, when you're on the attacking side, you're very single focused. You've got a very specific objective and you're going to invest a lot of energy, time and resources. Whereas on the other side, you know, there's just so much to consider and so much open thought to give. So maybe in the middle, something is quite good.
I mean, would Checkpoint, do you think, ever hire anyone who'd previously been pinged for a bit of freaking in their teenage years? I mean, say that they got done 15 years ago and they all of a sudden were a recognised authority on a particular type of security. Would a company like Checkpoint hire that person?
Well, look, I think any company would need to look at the skills on offer from that individual, you know, what they're, how they've reformed, and more importantly, you know, what they're going to bring to the table. To just discount any potential employee based on previous records or experience wouldn't exactly be a best practice situation.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, people would say under no circumstances would we hire anyone at all who had done anything that could even vaguely be constituted as illegal. We do not hire hackers. You would agree that there seems to have been a general shift in the industry.
So looking specifically at Moss and some other recent examples, I would agree that is definitely a trend in the industry.
Well, I guess too, Steve, that these sort of guys who'd actually dabbled a little bit with the dark side, when the proverbial brown stuff hits the fan, they're sort of the guys you want by your side, aren't they?
Well, at the end of the day, when you're in a crisis situation, you're not exactly looking to make new friends or new relationships. You only have time to leverage the people that you know. And if those kind of people are available by government, department or in the private sector, then yeah, that's obviously a positive outcome. You don't have to scrounge around. You can get on with response and action rather than sitting there in meeting rooms.
I've watched with tremendous interest over the time that I've been reporting on IT security, which has actually been a little while now, sad to say, time just has really marched on, but I have really watched with great interest as the scene, you know, and I use that in air quotes there, the scene has gradually become co-opted by industry, and industry has actually started to understand it a little bit more and realise that, you know, you can't put all of these pen testers in suits and all of that sort of stuff. And there seems to have been a bit of a meeting in the middle. And generally speaking, you go to a hacker-style event, and people aren't as suspicious as they used to be of industry guys, of law enforcement, of the media. Who do you think's given up the most ground in that exchange? Do you think it's been the sort of the hacker scene, which is, you know, all the enthusiasts who do it for fun, or do you think it's the establishment that's changed? Who's changed more?
Yeah, look, I mean, you look at some of the speakers at DEF CON this year, for example. There are some interesting presentations from various US government officials to do with their view of the world. So obviously both sides have been giving in terms of wanting to give a little more and also wanting to listen to the other side. You are right that there's definitely a meeting in the middle. Putting, you know, hackers, pen testers, or people who've had interesting former associates in suits isn't always the best outcome. But certainly in the middle, we all leverage and benefit a bit more.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's a strange hypocrisy, though, I feel, in that the establishment can appoint someone to a Homeland Security advisory and then send a blind 19-year-old to prison. I'm guessing part of that sentence, at least a few years of that, would be directly related to things like freaking charges. Do you see that as being a little bit hypocritical or an inherent sort of paradox in the great big establishment machine?
Well, look, if the Homeland Security Advisory Council, or HSAC, which I'm not sure if that means they play a lot of hacky sack, actually is an example there. There are 16 individuals appointed to that council. There's a fair bit of depth in that council in terms of, you know, former directors of Lockheed Martin. You know, I think there's a sheriff in there as well, just to to make sure the Wild West is tamed. So
yeah, they know how to get their hack on, those guys. I mean, exactly. You know, defense contractors and sheriffs.
I don't know how you keep your hat on whilst playing hacky sack like that, but once again, looking at the depth, you know, having a bit of a, you know, a balance in there is not a bad thing. So looking specifically at that council, you know, adding that level of depth is probably a good thing.
Okay, so I guess what we can draw from this conversation is that we have actually come a long way in getting our young hacklings out there understood by broader society. Steve McDonald, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Steve McDonald there with a look at the ever-changing relationship between the establishment and what we euphemistically call security enthusiasts. And that is it for this week's show. We'll take you out this week with a track called The Thong Song, or just thongs, but you should know that in Australia, thongs go on your feet, not on your ass. Just for clarification there. And this song is by Marshall and the Fro, and I actually have 10 copies of this album to give away. So be the first to leave a voicemail comment about this week's show to get your copy of Marshall and the Fro's album. So you can call Sydney 02-8569-1835. Or USA on 877-688-8417, and that's toll-free. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. In the sand at the ground, yeah, you know who I am. Hey, baby, see, but they're not thongs. Put them on your feet, but not your ass, no. So cheap, fibers a pop. I got a pair, baby, at the corner shop. So, see, with thongs, you can't go wrong. Everybody gonna put your thongs on. Put your thongs on. Put your thongs on, yeah. Gonna put your thongs on. I got my thongs on. Gonna put your thongs on, your thongs on, yeah. Won't put your thongs on. I got my thongs on. Won't put your thongs on, yeah.
Clean as a whistle. It says so in his resume.
He's as clean as a dirty whistle. How's that for some happy middle ground?
Yeah. No, look, he you know, he played with it when he was a teenager. He might have passed one around at a party.
But he didn't inhale.
He definitely didn't inhale.
All right.